You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:30. Coming up next, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear the La Penca bombing remembered. 30 years ago, a bomb went off in a press conference in La Penca, Nicaragua. Journalists and others are still trying to get answers about the bombing.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location each week.
We've always been concerned about intelligence services passing themselves off as journalists.
The rest of us were just lined up on the ground outside and laying there, and there was only a limited number of people who could fit in the one remaining boat.
Who would have known if somebody would have bombed, of all things, a press conference? I mean, they might as well bomb a church.
We didn't have a full grasp on the possibilities of what might happen, and that is always unsettling.
I'm Norman Stockwell of WORT-FM Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Today on Sprouts, we'll hear La Penca Remembered, a history of the La Penca bombing 30 years ago. May 30th is the National Day of the Journalist in Costa Rica. This day was first proclaimed in 2010 by then-President Oscar Arias Sanchez, the architect of the 1987 Central American Peace Accord called Esquipulas II, to honor the dead and wounded in a bombing that took place in La Penca, just across the northern border inside Nicaragua, on May 30, 1984. 4 people were killed, another 15 severely wounded, some so seriously as to lose eyes or limbs, during a press conference called by guerrilla leader Aiden Pastora. 3 journalists were killed that day, Costa Ricans Jorge Quiros, a cameraman for Channel 6 TV, and his assistant, Evelio Siqueira, and U.S. reporter Linda Frazier of the Tico Times newspaper. Her husband, Joe Frazier, who was then Latin America bureau chief for the Associated Press, remembers that day.
Yeah, I'd come back from dinner. I got to the Intercontinental Hotel, which is now called something else, and the clerk, whom I'd known for many years since the 79 revolution, said, Senor Frazier, there's been an explosion on the San Juan River. You need to know this. Of course, I was going into this dry mouth panic and tried to find out what I could. And I started calling everybody I knew in Costa Rica, calling in every favor I had out there, and I was getting a little panicky. Someone had gone up live on the San Juan where the boats were coming back from La Penca. And one of them said, well, there's a red-headed foreign lady here who is a correspondent, and she is sin vida, without life. And I knew then that this had to be it. I mean, there's no way it was anybody else. And about that time, the phone rang, and it was our bureau chief in Mexico City. He had been frantically calling around as well. Then he said, Joe, it's true. That's all I can tell you. It's true. And my mind just sort of went blank after that. And I realized that in the morning I had to go back to Costa Rica and tell our 10-year-old son what had happened. And that's something I don't wish on anybody.
Costa Rican journalist Nelson Murillo, now retired, was a few feet away asking Pastora a question when the bomb exploded.
I ended up burnt, injured, fractured. I was 2 months in physical therapy in a hospital. I was left with one shorter leg. Progressive deafness, PTSD, and spinal problems because of the shortening of the leg. I've already had 30 surgeries because of problems beginning in La Penca. They took 70 shrapnel pieces out of me, metallic pieces of the bomb. Since it was homemade, it had everything, screws, BBs, thumbtacks, etc. It's been a pilgrimage through the hospitals over 30 years. But there were people with amputations. Don Roberto Cruz, who died 19 years after the bombing of La Penca, lost an eye, an ear, and one leg. Out of those of us left, the present-day survivors, there were others with amputations, deformations, and other serious problems that have, over time, died from natural causes. But of those surviving today, I'm the only one left with the most serious health problems.
ABC cameraman Tony Avrigan remembers the long wait to get medical aid.
The rest of us were just lined up on the ground outside and laying there, and there was only a limited number of people who could fit in the one remaining boat. And it was a, it wasn't 4 hours there, it was 2 hours to San Carlos, but it was a 4 hour round trip. So perversely, the least injured rushed down to the boat and jumped in the boat, and that boat filled up, and they said, that's enough, and they took off. And I was laying on the ground, and I was not one of the most, seriously injured, but I knew I had a big hole in my side, and I had I thought of my leg was broken because I could feel the bone sticking out of the leg, and all the skin was burned off my face. And but next to me was Linda Frazier, and she had both of her legs blown off just below the knee, and she was in quite bad shape. And no one made any attempt to take her or the other people. There were many Costa Ricans who lost limbs or eyes and things, and it was the least injured people who got in that first boat, including the what we found out later was the bomber. And
Pastora, called Comandante Cero or Commander Zero, was a charismatic former Sandinista who was leading a rebel army against the Nicaraguan government headed by Daniel Ortega. Pastora was forming a southern front based out of Costa Rica. Stephen Kinzer, New York Times bureau chief in Managua at the time, explains that Pastora had fallen out of favor with the CIA.
The CIA was eagerly recruiting people who were not tainted by collaboration with the old dictatorship. Pastora was perfect for this. He was not only untainted by collaboration with Somoza, he had led one of the greatest operations that helped bring down Somoza. So the idea that he was then going to make himself available as an anti-Sandinista fighter was thought of as a great coup for the CIA. They tried to establish him in southern Costa Rica, and at the beginning, I think, had very high hopes for him. The people who were the main contra force up in the north, like Bermudez, were really based in the old National Guard of General Somoza. They hated Pastora, and Pastora hated them. The idea of the CIA was, these hatreds were just details. Now we've got a new cause. We're all trying to overthrow the Sandinista regime, so let's just put behind us all the quarrels of the past. Neither side was willing to do that, and that's why the alliance really never gelled the way the CIA wanted it to.
Aidan Pastora, now again working with Daniel Ortega and the current Nicaraguan government as Minister of Development of the Rio San Juan Basin, said the divisions were ideological and insurmountable.
Entonces había una gran presión de parte de la Central de Inteligencia Americana y de sectores de derecha.
Here was a great pressure from the American Central Intelligence and right-wing sectors for me to join the North, the counter-revolution of the FDN, which was founded, directed, and supplied by Central Intelligence. This was impossible for moral reasons, for political and ideological reasons. On moral terms, these guardias from the North murdered my father when I was 8 years old. And when I was older, when I was 40 years old, they murdered my people in a genocide, so I could not join them for political reasons.
Genocidio asesinaron a mi pueblo, entonces políticamente yo no me podía unir.
Journalist John Lee Anderson was with Pastora's forces a month before La Penca.
I found out, of course, eventually that he was getting money from the CIA, and in fact, on that attack that I joined his forces for on in April of 1984 on San Juan del Norte, I discovered that he had direct CIA help. Not only had the CIA organized airdrops of logistics on certain Americans' ranches, a network of American ranches who were sort of operating as proxies for the CIA in Costa Rica, but they had also helped shell the town from offshore from a gunboat. And Pastora confirmed this with me, you know, begged me not to report it. I had it from several other commanders and lieutenants. In the course of the battle, I had learned this information. And I really confirmed this. And this was, of course, inconvenient at the time for a lot of people because it was only a week or so since the mining of the harbors scandal had been aired in public and supposedly put to bed. This dealt with news that had leaked out that the CIA had illegally, of course, mined Nicaragua's harbors as an effort to stop the regime from being resupplied by the Soviet bloc, or for that matter, to carry on any kind of commerce whatsoever. And it had been confirmed in Washington, and there had been hearings about it. And just the week before, I believe, the San Juan del Norte attack, the magazine I then worked for, Time, had a cover which basically involved the kind of velvet, it was a kind of velvet glove solution to the mining of the harbors. The CIA had had its hand slapped. There was now going to be more congressional oversight of the aid to the Contras program. Eventually, this led to the stipulation of humanitarian assistance being, non-lethal aid and so forth. And for those who supported the aid to the Contras and some kind of policy that would destabilize and undermine the Sandinistas, the news that there was actual active attack post-mining of the harbor scandal by the CIA was pretty inconvenient. As it turned out, I got in a fair bit of trouble over it within Time magazine as a result, my biggest scoop of my young career.
On May 1st, Aidan Pastora had been given a 30-day ultimatum by the CIA to join forces with the FDN, and on the 30th, he called a press conference.
Entonces llamé a una conferencia de prensa para denunciar al mundo.
I called the press conference to denounce these issues to the world and to tell the world that I was not joining the counter-revolution from my stance as a revolutionary, from my stance as a Sandinista. At that moment, I was a dissident. I was at odds with the National Directorate of the Sandinista National Liberation Front. So the reason for the conference specifically was to denounce to the people of Nicaragua and to the world the pressure that I would not give in or to concede.
La presión a la que yo no me sometía, a la que yo no cedía.
Investigator John Mattis, who worked in the Miami Public Defender's Office and later provided support to the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Narcotics, and International Operations, chaired by Senator John Kerry, explains that this was really part of a much larger, complex operation.
Fronted by drug smugglers and con men. And if you boil it all down to that, it was a mercenary adventure by elements of the Contras to sell a war to the United States so that they could engage in massive drug smuggling, and that's really what it turned out to be. He was a liability to everyone. He was, of course, a liability to the Sandinistas, and he was a liability to the Southern Front because he, in fact, was going to get in the way of the Chamorros, Popo Chamorro, and others who had their own ideas of what Costa Rica should look like and the Southern Front should look like.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Norman Stockwell of WORT-FM Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Lapenka Remembered, a history of the 1984 Lapenka bombing. You can find a print version of this story in the Tico Times of Costa Rica, ticotimes.net/Lapenka30Years. Tony Avergan and his wife, journalist Martha Honey, undertook an investigation to find the identity of the bomber. Martha, now co-founder and director of the Center for Responsible Travel in Washington, D.C., recalls,
"Well, I think we, in the after Tony was injured and was operated on in Costa Rica and then taken to a hospital in Philadelphia. It was medevaced by ABC television to Philadelphia. And as I was preparing to go up, I was contacted by the Committee to Protect Journalists and another U.S. press committee in the U.S. and asked if I would be willing to undertake an investigation as to what was who was responsible for the bombing. And, of course, I had lots of reasons for wanting to get to the bottom of this. And so I said yes and went up and met with them and so on and thought that, this would be a couple of weeks or possibly months of investigation and we would learn what had happened. And literally, until today, we don't know the full story."
The case was later taken on by a public interest law firm known as the Christic Institute and incorporated into their larger lawsuit against a secret team inside and outside the U.S. government. But, Martha says, they had a serious falling out.
Doug Vaughn was hired by the Christic Institute when we got involved with the lawsuit with the Christic Institute. And so he was an investigator with them for many years. But he, like us, had a very serious falling out with Danny Sheehan, the chief lawyer there. And basically, we kind of broke with Danny and with sort of the official Christic Institute and a group of us, including Doug Vaughn and Carl Deal and Joanne Royce, who was one of the lawyers, and you know a number of others kind of kept doing, Richard McGough kept doing investigation, but really not so much for the Christic Institute, but simply because we were trying to get to the bottom of what was going on.
The actual bomber was ultimately identified through the work of investigator Doug Vaughn and others. It was Vaughn who first uncovered the fingerprint and photo of the suspect in Panamanian immigration files. Vaughn initially worked with Avergan and Honey and the Christic Institute and later provided material to Juan Tamayo of the Miami Herald. Tamayo, a close friend of Joe and the late Linda Frazier, said he felt obligated to try and find the perpetrators.
Since I was a friend of Joe and Linda Frazier, and when she died at the Lubyanka bombing, I always thought that, you know, we all had a responsibility as journalists to try to solve the murder of a fellow journalist, much like the Don Bolin case in Arizona, that gave rise to the investigative reporters, IRE, I forgot what it's called. So it was a personal interest, and for many, many years, every chance I had, I sort of asked people, do you know anything about this? You know, anybody I thought might know something about the case, what happened, etc.
It was eventually determined that Gauguine had died in 1989 in a failed assault on the La Tablada barracks in Argentina. But because no firm evidence of his death was found, an Interpol warrant for his arrest remained open. Then, on December 2nd, Attorney General Jorge Chavarria Guzman gave a press conference, saying the investigation was closed because in Costa Rica there was no more information or clues about the masterminds of the attack. But he said that if any other country, like Nicaragua, has new information, the case in Costa Rica could be reopened, since it has been classified as a crime against humanity, which does not expire. Peter Torbjornsson was a Swedish journalist who now admits that he was also spying for the Sandinistas in 1984. He regularly gave copies of his footage to Nicaraguan intelligence services under the direction of Comandante Tomas Borge. It was Torbjornsson who brought the fake journalist Per Anker Hansen to the press conference that day. He recently produced an introspective 90-minute film full of personal agony called The Last Chapter, Goodbye Nicaragua, released in festivals in 2010 and first shown in Costa Rica and Nicaragua in 2011. The film also features British journalist Susie Morgan, who was seriously wounded at Lubyanka. Morgan has sought to solve the crime for the past three decades and made her own investigative film for British television in 1988 and authored an autobiographical account of the investigation entitled In Search of the Assassin. Morgan was standing right next to Pastora when the explosion took place and feels it was her body that actually shielded him from some of the worst effects of the blast. Aiden Pastora, now 77, whose legs were injured by the explosion, spent several weeks in a hospital in Venezuela recuperating after plastic surgery. Pastora says,
it was people such as Torbjornsson who did the reconnaissance. He spent 15 days with me and brought the information to the Sandinistas and to the CIA because he was a double agent, as was the fake journalist Per Anker Hansen, whose real name was Roberto Vital Gauguine. They were crazy people who liked to experience intense thrills, working with the left and with the right. They were double agents. Roberto Vital Gauguine died at La Tablada during the assault to the headquarters of the Cara Pintadas in Buenos Aires, and Torbjornsson is still playing his role as a double agent, sent by the Central Intelligence to disinform the people, feigning outrage and accusing the Frente directly. The truth is, the Frente gave the order to place the bomb, but at a camp. They gave the order to place the bomb under a hammock, since that was what Torbjornsson had recommended, not at a press conference. It was a decision by Torbjornsson and Roberto Vital Gauguine to place it at Lubyanka because they had not been able to hunt me down for 3 months. I hadn't given them the opportunity to do it at a camp or other places where I camped. People don't know these things about these double agents, Torbjörnsson and Roberto Vital Gagwine.
La gente desconoce todas estas cosas, de estos dobles agentes, Torbjörnsson y Roberto Vital Gagwine.
Pastora has suggested that Torbjörnsson, now 73, should be officially accused of crimes committed against humanity for his role in facilitating the plot. Torbjörnsson responded that, quote, Aidan Pastora has gotten the supervision of Rio San Juan in compensation for his effort to transform himself into a mouthpiece for his former enemies. He has forgotten his moral obligation to the other victims, the right to know the truth. Lapenka had a profound impact on those who were there or had friends there. John Lee Anderson notes that
the Pastora hit was maybe the first of the type of assassination in which explosives were used under cover of journalists. Everything's changed since then. I mean, that was shocking to us, and it was dangerous. Of course, it made our lives very dangerous. It suddenly thrust all of us. I'm speaking now about Lapenka 30 years ago. It made us feel that we couldn't trust people in quite the same way. It made everybody wonder where we stood. Who were the people we were dealing with, both in regimes and in these sort of, you know, the insurgent movements and the people that traveled in those circles.
Juan Tamayo concurs.
We've always, you know, been sort of concerned about intelligence services passing themselves off as journalists. We find that to be, you know, objectionable because it puts real journalists at risk. Any number of journalists can then get arrested because some government thinks that they are, you know, spies or something. So not only does the killer pass himself off as a journalist, but he then sets off the bomb in a news conference. I don't think it could have been any worse. That was a blot on journalism.
Joe Frazier.
I think we all just sort of realized that it was a risky shot out there, and that you do your best to be careful, and there are some things you can't avoid. Now, who would have known, or who would have thought that somebody would have bombed, of all things, a press conference? I mean, they might as well bomb a church.
Stephen Kinzer.
I was in total shock. My first reaction was that my friends had been attacked. One of the women who was a victim of that attack, Susan Morgan, lived in Managua, and I used to see her every other day. Linda Frazier was a real bedrock of the press corps in Costa Rica. Several of those other people present were people that I worked with all the time. We had never had an episode like this before. And then after I recovered from my shock at realizing what had happened to my colleagues, it dawned on me that it could easily have been me. Just by a trick of fate, I didn't happen to be there. But this was a stunning episode, far beyond anything that we had anticipated. I don't think it changed our minds about anything, but it intensified our feeling that we were in a deeply unpredictable and highly violent situation. It really showed that we didn't have a full grasp on the possibilities of what might happen, and that is always unsettling.
Nelson Murillo.
Bueno, sin querer, con el tiempo y sobre todo después de la muerte de Don Roberto Cruz, que luchó mucho por...
Especially after the death of Don Roberto Cruz, who fought long to find the truth of these things and fought against the scandalous impunity of the case, in time he began to turn into an activist for this cause. Because the only hope for justice that is left to us is an international trial through the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, where there's a denunciation presented by the Association of Journalists in August of 2005 when the case of Lapenka already had 21 years impunity. Now it has been 30 years, more than 8 years of waiting, and denouncement is still being processed through to admission. They have not said yes or no officially.
Attorney Chavarria, in his 1989 report to the Costa Rican Legislative Assembly, concluded with the statement, "To finalize, this report does not put an end to the investigation of the crime of Lapenka, which should continue in the clarification of events. A great deal of useful information is in the United States, and it will depend on the good faith of the authorities of that country to access what has been censored in the Senate reports." Now that three decades have passed and many of the witnesses and participants are no longer alive, a resolution seems difficult. On the day of the bombing, Mike Boettcher of NBC News had reported, quote, "The blast occurred in a no-man's land along a river that separates Nicaragua and Costa Rica. There is no law there, so it will be nearly impossible to determine who planted the bomb and why." Juan Tamayo echoes this thought today.
The other thing is the crime took place in Nicaragua. The Costa Ricans have sort of become involved in it because many of the victims were Costa Ricans, but the crime, the bombing actually took place in Nicaragua. So is the Nicaraguan government now under former Sandinista president Daniel Ortega willing to dig up this old history? I doubt it very much.
Costa Rican journalist Nelson Murillo.
El mercenario que detonó la bomba esté fallecido.
Although the mercenary that detonated the bomb is dead and registered as such in Argentina, the responsibility of the intellectual author is another thing that is still in force and is a goal which we must investigate deeply and inform and denounce all that appears in time.
Jose Rodolfo Ibarra was also injured at La Penca. He was later president of the Association of Costa Rican Journalists. For him, it is important to keep the memory of La Penca alive.
I would hope that this 30th of May, the 30th anniversary of that act, that the new generation of journalists do not forget what happened there. We have to learn from what happened there. May they not forget the dead and the injured. It's necessary to be aware of what happened there so it doesn't happen again.
Investigator Doug Vaughn.
In many cases, what we know or want to believe in the way of wishful thinking is undone by the facts all the time. And still we have to reconcile ourselves to that. And then if we really believe in a cause, we have to move forward. You have to do it by telling the truth. Let the chips fall.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to La Penca Remembered. Assistance for this program came from Sarah Blasky and Jesse Chapman in Costa Rica. This show first aired on WORT's Third World View. The music you heard was traditional street music recorded in San Jose, Costa Rica. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA@pacifica.org. This week's program producer was myself, Norman Stockwell, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Muertos Northwest's 6th Annual Celebration Under the Bridge on Dia de los Muertos, Saturday, November 1st at 1 p.m. This year's celebration will include the creation of altars, sugar skull decorating, Muertos face painting for all ages, Muertos storytelling, and live music by Los Tex-Maniacs. Again, that's Muertos Northwest's 6th Annual Celebration Under the Bridge, Saturday, November 1st, from 1 p.m. to midnight at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Friday, October 31st, Halloween night. Dr. Zom Stereo Obscura, the AV Squad, and Radio Lost and Found present a Halloween radio extravaganza. From 8 p.m. to 3 a.m., it's a horror-filled ghost train ride through frightening sounds, scary soundtracks, ghoulish songs, and other surprises. That's Halloween.